We turn again this morning to the letter to the Hebrews, and we come now to chapter 9. In our studies in Hebrews, we have been looking at this great epistle to the Hebrews for some considerable time now in our morning studies. And we have been noticing that this is the high priesthood epistle. Indeed, it is the only book in the New Testament which specifically speaks of Jesus Christ as our great high priest. We have pointed out that there are other places in the New Testament, and indeed in the Old Testament too, where Messiah is a priest. He performs priestly functions. You remember in Isaiah 53, he makes his soul an offering for sin, and then he makes intercession on behalf of sinners. And that, of course, is the work of the priests in Israel in ancient times. And this epistle is reminding us in great detail of how it is that Jesus Christ, in fact, does perform the work of a great high priest. And in so doing, the writer in this epistle is describing for us the fundamentals of true Christianity. This letter to the Hebrews, the more I have been studying it over the past number of years, and again, for these sermons on Sunday mornings, the more I am inclined to think that this probably is my favorite epistle in the New Testament. And you might think it's strange for people to have their favorite books of the Bible. Well, some great men in the church have had their favorites. Martin Luther's favorite epistle was the Epistle to the Galatians. The epistle to the Ephesians was John Calvin's favorite epistle. And there's one of my favorite preachers in Scotland who has recently gone to glory. And his favorite epistle was the Epistle to the Romans. So there's no harm in us having a book that we find particularly useful and particularly helpful. And I'm sure we all have our portions of the Bible that we come to again and again because it teaches us the things that we really need to know. And the more I study this epistle to the Hebrews, the more I find myself enamored with the grandeur of it, the big picture that is being presented, as well as the close, fine detail that the writer is presenting before us. Now, we've been looking at some of these great truths over the past weeks and months. And we finished off last Sunday morning in the 8th chapter, looking once again at the closing verses of that chapter, you may remember, dealing with the New Covenant, quotation from Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 34, where the writer was reminding us that the replacement of the law of Moses and all the administration and the structure of Moses' law administration was something that was always destined to pass away. It wasn't something that suddenly came to pass. The new covenant, the coming of Christ into the world, is not something that is unexpected. It's not a novelty. It's something of which the Old Testament has quite a lot to say. And the writer quotes from Jeremiah chapter 31 concerning the days coming when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers when I took them out of the house of bondage. And we looked at the new covenant in comparison to the old, and then we noticed last Sunday morning particularly the threefold promise that was given, the terms, as it were, that are brought into focus concerning this new covenant. The law of God was going to be in every one of their hearts. In the Old Testament, under Moses, it didn't matter if you were converted, really, in a sense. It didn't matter. You didn't have to be converted to be under the covenant. You were under the law of Moses, whether you were a believer or not. All you had to be was a member of the nation of Israel. But those who were under this new covenant, every one of them is one who has in his heart or her heart the law of God. And we instinctively do and love the law of God. And then they all know the Lord. They shall not need to be taught by every other one know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least to the greatest. And then finally, there is the final forgiveness, and indeed the forgetting of sin. And I will be merciful to their unrighteousnesses, and their sins and their iniquities I will remember no more. Under the law of Moses, there was a continual reminder of sin, and we're going to come back to this again this morning. And in chapter 10, we're going to come back to it again, because God would not allow the people of Israel to forget their sin under the Old Testament administration. But under the New Covenant, our sin is forgiven and forgotten, and God will never bring it again before Him. And there's no need for us continually to remember the sins that have already been forgiven. And we'll see and explore further how all this works out in detail. Well, we come this morning to chapter 9. It's important for us to remember that the original manuscripts of our Bible, they do not have chapter divisions in the way that we have in our present-day Bibles. The writers of the books of the Bible, they simply continued from one theme to the next. There were divisions, of course, as one theme and thought followed another. And there was a sense in which you could go to a place. You remember how Jesus speaks, for example, to the Sadducees who were arguing about the resurrection and denying and saying, do you remember that place in Moses, in the place about the bush? And everybody who knew his Old Testament would know where to go in the book of Exodus, because he would know that that's the place where God spoke to Moses in the bush in the wilderness. So there were these divisions, but not chapter divisions, as we have them in our present-day Bibles. And so when we come to chapter 9, we're not coming to a different theme in a sense. We are simply following on from what we have been looking at in the past four Sunday mornings in chapter 8. And we were making the point in chapter 8 that that is the central chapter. If you want to know the true meaning of Hebrews, then understand chapter 8 in Hebrews, and you will know the details of the rest of the epistle. And as I made the point, if you want to understand Romans, then understand Romans chapter 6, and you will get the message of what Romans is really all about. And if you want to understand the Gospel of John, read and memorize the first 18 verses of John's Gospel, the prologue. That is what John's Gospel all is about. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld His glory. The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. That's what John's Gospel is all about. And the rest of the Gospel of John is really an expansion of these introductory themes and thoughts in the Gospel. Now, there are these clues and keys in the Bible as to how to understand the bigger picture and the rest of the book, whatever the teaching may be. Now, we have made the point that up until chapter 8, the first seven chapters, they were leading up to chapter 8 in Hebrews. Now, the sum of what we have been speaking about, he says, is this: we have such a high priest. So this in chapter 8, the teaching of chapter 8, the heavenly ministry of Christ, as opposed to the earthly tent for the Levitical priesthood, and the permanence and the finality of Christ's covenant over and above the temporariness and indeed the ineffectiveness, we might say, of the law of Moses. It is all, as it were, summarized. This is what he's been pointing to. Now, when we come to chapter 9, he is going to lead on from there. Chapter 8 is the foundational text for what he now begins to do in some detail. He's not just going to leave us with the tent, the earthly tent. He's going to describe it, and he's going to tell us about its significance in some detail. The people to whom he is writing this great epistle, they are converted Jews, or they may be converted Gentiles, who are thoroughly familiar with the teaching of the Old Testament. And so there's a great deal of assumption on the part of the writer concerning the knowledge of those to whom he is writing. He is assuming that they are following his arguments. He is assuming that they know what he's talking about. And what he is trying to do over and over again, while they are regretting the passing of all the outward form and structure and paraphernalia and the glory indeed of the Mosaic legislation and the Old Testament worship, the writer is trying to make the point again and again. Yes, all that glory has gone, but it has been replaced by something far, far better, something more glorious. And this is why in these earlier chapters he's been comparing Jesus to the angels and to Moses and to the Levitical priests. And in every single instance he says, Jesus Christ is greater. He's greater than Moses. He's greater than the angels. He's greater than all the Levitical priests put together. His sacrifice is greater than all the sacrifices of the Old Testament. And now he's going to begin to explain to us in detail wherein the greatness of Christ lies. And this is what we want to begin to look at this morning. We're going to look at these first 10 verses, and I'll read them very, very quickly. Then truly the first covenant had also ordinance of divine service, a worldly sanctuary. There was a tabernacle made, a tent, the first wherein was the candlestick, the table, the showbread. This is called the sanctuary. After the second veil, he says, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, which are the golden censer, the ark of the covenant, and so on and so on. We'll go through it in detail. I won't read it again. But we're looking this morning at the opening 10 verses of this chapter. And he's laying the foundation for what he's going to speak about right throughout this chapter and into chapter 10 up to verse number 18. Everything that follows is an exposition of the significance of what went on in the tabernacle in Old Testament Israel. And the writer begins by reminding us that just as there are certain terms under the new covenant, the terms of God's law in the hearts of his people, the knowledge of God, the forgiveness of sin, so he says there were certain terms and regulations that had to be fulfilled even under the Old Testament law of Moses. And this is how he begins chapter 9. Then verily, he says, the first, the word covenant here, as I'm sure you notice in your Bibles, it is in italics. That means it's not in the original text. It's been put in to give out the full meaning. Then verily, the first covenant, he says, had also ordinances and of divine service. The word here for service is the word for divine worship. It's the word latria, and it means specifically worship that has to do with religious worship. So he's saying that under the Old Testament, under the first covenant, he says there were certain regulations. This word ordinances means rules and regulations properly observed. There were certain things that had to be done right. And we have already seen in chapter 7 that Moses was commanded, make sure that you obey everything and that you make the tent according to the pattern that was showed to you on the mountain. And so the writer here is simply reminding us that yes, there were these rules and regulations, and they had to be punctiliously and righteously indeed observed, and ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary. And the way that the writer handles this series of ordinances and rules under the Old Testament is rather interesting. He begins with a kind of description of the Old Testament tabernacle. Now, he's not speaking about the temple. He's speaking about the tabernacle. The temple came later, and then there was another temple. And then there was Herod's temple, which was even different and greater again. He is not speaking of the temple. He is speaking of the original tabernacle, because the tabernacle in the wilderness was the pattern. It was the template, if you like, of the temple of Solomon, the temple of Haggai, and the temple of Herod. The tabernacle in the wilderness is the original earthly pattern. And that's what he's talking about. And he begins by reminding us that there was the building or the preparation of a tent, a tabernacle. That's what the word a tent means. But he immediately is reminding us, right at the beginning, before he goes on to give any description as to what it was like or what went on there, he is reminding us it was temporary. It was meant to be temporary because it was worldly. And the word here for worldly means belonging to this world. This word only occurs in one other place in our Greek New Testament, And it is in Titus where the apostle says to Titus that we are to abandon worldly passions. They belong to this world only. They don't belong to heaven really. And our writer here is reminding us, and he's reminding his readers, that from the very beginning, the tabernacle in the wilderness and everything that flowed from it was never meant to belong ultimately to heavenly realities. It was always meant to be temporary. And the terrible tragedy of Israel was that they imagined that this earthly tabernacle, this was the real thing. Even Abraham knew better than these people did, because he was looking for a heavenly city which has foundations, whose builder and whose maker is God. So the writer here is reminding us about this tabernacle. It was made, he says. And he goes on to describe the tabernacle. Now, you can read all about these things if you read in the book of Exodus in chapter 25, in chapter 37, and again in chapter 40, because these descriptions that the writer is giving to us here in these opening verses, they are all found slightly differently, but nonetheless they are found in greater detail in the book of Exodus from chapter 25 onwards. So you can read it all there if you want to compare Hebrews chapter 9 with what is actually said in the book of Exodus. These are the chapters to go to. But he begins to describe what the tabernacle was like. And he reminds us that the tabernacle had, as it were, two courts. There were actually more than two courts later on, but in the beginning there were two courts. There was one that he calls the first sanctuary, or the first holy place, and then there was the second, behind the second veil. The first veil was the entrance. It was like the door, and when you went through the first veil, you entered into the outer court, as it were, and he doesn't mention this, but when you were into the tabernacle, you would find a great laver, a great basin of water made of brass, and as the priests went in, they had to wash there. And then you went further in and you found that there was an altar, the altar of sacrifice. He doesn't mention that. The writer is not concerned here to give to us a full description of the tabernacle. He doesn't do that. He is giving us a general picture. And indeed, in verse number 5, he reminds us, I'm not going to speak about this particularly. He's not interested in all these details. He's interested rather in the significance of it all. So he reminds us of these two courts, as it were. And he says, the first holy place, wherein was the candlestick and the table and the showing of the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. Now, he misses out something in this list, but he includes it in the second. And it is, if you went into the tabernacle, having passed by the laver for washing and the altar for sacrifice, you would find that on one side there was a lampstand, and it was kept continually lit. Day and night it was lit by the priests who went in there every single day, trimming the lamps and putting in the oil and so forth. And without going into too much detail concerning the significance of these furnishings, it's pretty obvious. This is a symbol of the light that belongs to God's religion. And this very candlestick is taken up, for example, by our Lord Jesus Christ, by implication, you're the light of the world. It is taken up in the book of Revelation, the idea of a candlestick. You remember the seven churches, they are the seven candlesticks. And so the lampstand here is the candlesticks, or the lampstand. It was where the lights were, and it was oil burning. Olive oil was burning there, continually reminding the people of God that if they want understanding and light, they must come to God for it. That basically is what it was meaning. And then on the other side of the outer court, there was this table. And there were there these 12 loaves of bread. And these 12 loaves of bread were to be eaten by the priests only. They were to be changed every Sabbath. And they were a continual reminder to us that the bread of this world is always wasting. It needs to be replenished. And we need to rely upon the bread of heaven. And when Jesus Christ speaks of himself as being the light of the world and the bread that comes from heaven, he is making reference to these symbolic furnishings that we find in the Old Testament. Now, we could go further into that, but we're not concerned to do so, because the writer is not concerned to do so. And so he says, this outward court, or this first court, he says, it is called the sanctuary, literally the holy place. And then he begins to describe another sanctuary. And he calls it after the holy place that is after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all. And this is what we would know as the Holy of Holies. Now, it is interesting here that he speaks of this holy of all, this holiest of all, as being behind the second veil. And we would maintain that this is the same veil that is referred to in chapter 6 at verse number 19. Which hope we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and which entereth into that within the veil. It's the same word. And behind that veil was that place where God was to be found, where indeed atonement was to be made. And we are reminded in chapter 6 in Hebrews at verse 19 that Jesus Christ has gone into that holy place behind the veil. It is the second veil, so to speak. And he has gone there as the forerunner is for us. He has entered in. Jesus Christ made a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And I think all the commentators and the scholars who link these two veils together, chapter 6 at verse 19 with chapter 9 here at verse number 3, I think they're exactly right, because this is evidently the place where Christ has gone, and the writer is going to speak about that later on in this very chapter, as we're going to see. And so he speaks of the second place behind the second veil, and then immediately we come across a problem in verse number 4. And the writer here says, and this holiest of all, this holy place behind the second veil, he begins to describe the furnishings. And he says, which had the golden censer, the ark of the covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna, and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant, and over it the cherubim of glory shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot now speak particularly. Now, where does the difficulty arise? The difficulty arises at the beginning of verse number 4, because according to the book of Exodus, where all this is described, there was no golden censer behind the second veil. All that you had was the rest of the furnishings are exactly what you would find, but there was no golden censer. And this has caused some of the scholars and indeed some of the critics to argue that here our writer, he doesn't understand his Old Testament and he's got it wrong. But we mustn't be so quick to condemn the man, because he is saying something, or he seems to be saying something, which is slightly different to what we find in the book of Exodus that in fact describes this. Because all that the writer is saying at the beginning of verse number 4 concerning the second holiest of all is, which has having the golden censer. This word perhaps should be translated not as the golden censer, but as the altar of incense, the golden altar of incense. Because when you went into the outer court, you would find on one side at the lampstand, you would find on the other side, you would find the table and the showbread, but in the middle, immediately in front of the entrance into the holiest of all, you would find a golden altar of incense. And there was continual incense burnt there, just as the lights were continually lit. The incense was continually attended to, and once in the week the bread of the showbread would be changed. And it seems that what the writer is actually referring to is not so much the fact that this golden altar here is actually behind the veil, but that when the veil was open, this altar of incense stood exactly over the open door, and the incense could be seen, and indeed it could enter into the holy place. Now, there are other arguments, there are other alternative views, and I could spend a bit of time talking about that. But that is the best explanation, because the writer is not strictly saying that inside the holiest of holies there is this golden altar. He is saying that the golden altar belongs to what is inside the holiest of all. And there is no question that when the high priest went into the holy place, he went in carrying blood, and he had an incense altar. He had an altar, an incense censer. But the writer is not saying necessarily that this altar of incense was behind the veil. He says it's connected with what was behind the veil. And undoubtedly it was, because what went on behind the veil was not only the sprinkling of blood, but the making of intercession on behalf of the sins of the people. And then he goes on to describe the rest of the furnishings. He says, the golden altar, The Ark of the Covenant, the Ark was a box. It was overlaid with gold and round about with gold. And in this box, this Ark of the Covenant, as it is called, there were certain items put. There was the golden pot that had manna. You remember in Exodus chapter 16, there was that manna from heaven. And Moses was commanded to take what we would call about a pint of it, put it into a golden vessel, and put it into the Ark of the Covenant as a continual reminder to the people of Israel how God had supplied all their needs in the wilderness. They still had bread and to spare. And this bread, manna, was put into the Ark of the Covenant as a continual reminder to Israel of God's supply in the desert. And then there was Aaron's rod that budded. You read about that in the book of Numbers, chapter 17. You remember there was some argument among the people of Israel as to the idea that Moses and Aaron, they were taking too much upon themselves, and that they were, as it were, taking a position of leadership that didn't belong to them. And you remember the test that was put. 12 rods were put out, one representing each of the tribes. And you remember in the morning, the following morning, it was Aaron's rod, the tribe of Levi, that had budded, and all the other rods remained, as it were, barren. And by that symbolism, the Lord was reminding Israel not to argue concerning which is the priestly tribe. It is the tribe of Aaron. It's the tribe of Levi. These are the lawful priests. And so this rod of Aaron that budded was a continual reminder to the people of Israel that the priesthood belonged, this is the high priesthood, belonged to the children of Aaron and to nobody else until the time of Reformation came. And the tables of the covenant. This, of course, is the covenant written in stone. There were these two tablets. And there are different views as to what these two tablets were. We often get them picturesquely presented to us as two tablets. And on one tablet, you have the first four commandments, our duty to God. And on the second tablet, you have from commandment number 5 to 10, our duties to man. Now, that is a possible explanation, but I'm not convinced that it's absolutely the only way to consider it. Because there are those scholars who argue that each of these tablets, they each had the Ten Commandments. And what you have is two copies. One belonging to each copy belonging to the two partners, as it were, in the agreement. A copy for you, a copy for me. A copy for God, as it were, and a copy for his people. And so it is quite possible that these two tablets of the Ten Commandments did not contain the first four and then the next six commandments, but each contained, in fact, the whole of the Ten Commandments. I'm not going to argue one way or the other. You can read about it in the arguments that the scholars love to argue about. But there are cogent reasons why we should consider, because this is a covenant between peoples, and it is common even in our own day. You sign an agreement, you get a copy, and the other partner gets a copy as well, and we both have a full copy of the terms and the penalties of whatever the contract is. And that is probably how we're to understand the two tablets of the commandments that were put in to the Ark of the Lord. And then the cherubim of mercy, these were angels. The Ark was like a box. It was covered with gold. It had a lid, and upon the lid it was highly ornamented with two angels. Their wings seemed to meet, and it seemed that they were meeting and brooding over the holy Ark of the Lord. And this is the mercy seat. The word for the lid of the Ark is called the mercy seat. It's the hilasterion. And that's the place where atonement is made, because it's linked into a word that means to make an atonement. And when Paul speaks of Jesus Christ as our atonement, set forth as our atonement, in Romans chapter 3, for example, you remember, he is no doubt linking it into this place, because it was here that God was saying that he would make an atonement, and the blood of atonement was sprinkled on the mercy seat. So in the inner shrine of God's tabernacle in the wilderness, we have all the essential furnishings that portray God's dealing with his people, supplying their light, supplying their bread, giving to them opportunities for mercy, making intercession continually, because mercy is to be found from the God of Israel under certain terms. So this is what this all really represents in broad outline. And the writer reminds us that he's not going to, as it were, go on to speak over much concerning these descriptions of the tabernacle. But then from verse 7 and 6 and 7, he reminds us of the ministry that took place within the tabernacle. Now, this is the real point of it all. The tabernacle in itself was not an end in itself. It was simply a means to an end. And we must be very careful, even as Christian people, that we do not see the earthly things of the church as being an end in themselves. They're only a means to an end. Buildings, even the Lord's Supper, the sacraments, for example, baptism and the Lord's Supper, these are not an end in themselves. They are a means of grace. They point to something else. And what the writer is reminding us here in verses 6 and 7, basically, is that the tabernacle was simply the place where the real work of ministry went on. This was where worship really began to take on its meaning, not in the furnishings, but in the people who were allowed to enter in to these holy places of God. And he tells us that into the first, the outer court, he tells us the priests went. Now, when these things were thus ordained, the priests went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. It's the same word for worship that we have at the beginning in verse number 1. So there is worship. And the priests went in representing the people. And they trimmed the lamps. They offered the sacrifices. They offered incense. They were the ones who took care, the priests. And every day it was the same. This was a daily, repetitious, day by day, week by week, century by century activity. But in contrast to that, he says, in verse number 7, he says, in contrast to that, there was into the holy place, behind the second veil, he says, only one priest was allowed to enter. And he wasn't allowed to enter, as it were, every day. He could only go in himself alone once in the year, he tells us in verse 7. But into the second went the high priest alone once every year, and not without blood. He had to go in for a purpose. And the purpose was very simply to take blood and to sprinkle the seat of atonement with blood, the blood of the sacrifices, and to take in his incense, a censer, and to make intercession for the sins of the people. Now, this is impressed because here the writer begins to speak about blood. And before we are finished with this chapter in a few weeks' time, we're going to see that the writer places a great deal of importance to blood, because it is blood that is the foundational ingredient of authentic Christianity. It is when I see the blood I will pass over. And as the writer, goes on to say from verse 11 onwards, it is blood that purchased for us our eternal redemption. It is the blood of Christ that, as it were, purges our consciences from dead works to serve the living and the true God. What is the importance of blood? Why this insistence and this continual repetition in Hebrews chapter 9 on blood, blood, blood? Well, we'll need to see that. But here we are being reminded that the high priest could not go into that holy place unless he was carrying blood. And that is highly significant. This was the Day of Atonement. And you read all about it in the book of Leviticus in chapter 16. And this blood, we're told, it was first of all for himself. He had to be covered with blood or sprinkled with blood before he was allowed to enter behind the second veil. And also blood for the errors of the people. The word here, errors, is ignorances. We're going to see in chapter 10 that under the Old Testament legislation, there was no sacrifice offered for deliberate sin. You read all about it in Numbers chapter 25. If a man sinned with a high hand, deliberately sinning, trampling on conscience, trampling on the blood of Christ, then there was no sacrifice offered. The sins of Israel that were covered by the blood of atonement were sins of ignorance, sins of weakness, sins in which the individual didn't really know what he was doing. And we have to keep that in mind, because that is one of the basic ingredients whereby sin even your sin and mine as possible. The Apostle Paul reminds us, does he not, in 1 Timothy chapter 1, that he received mercy. I received mercy because I did it ignorantly and in unbelief. Our Lord Jesus Christ on the cross of Calvary, when he was praying for those who were putting him on the cross, he said, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. There is a terrible ignorance in human sin. And there's a sense in which that's what makes it forgivable. Because God recognizes the infirmity and the ignorance of sinful human beings. And he pities us in our ignorance and in our infirmities. And he is pleased to pardon. But for the deliberate sin, which we've already touched upon in chapter 6, there's no forgiveness. There was no offering for blood for sins committed with a high, rebellious hand against the Lord. They were cut off from the people of Israel. And so the high priest went in once for the sins of the people, once in the year. But just as daily the priest had to go in day by day by day, so the high priest had to go in year by year. The Day of Atonement came. And then the Day of Atonement would come again. And then the following year, and the following decade, and the following centuries, always more and more, atonement was never finally and fully made. And the people were continually reminded, yes, the sins are covered for a year, but what about next year's sins? Well, there will need to be another atonement made. A continual repetitiousness. And the very repetitiousness of the whole system pointed surely to the fact that through this whole system of legalistic offering of sacrifices, forgiveness of sin is never brought to perfection. And that's why the writer goes on to speak the blood of bulls and of goats. He says it cannot take away sin. If that can't take away sin, what does? The blood of Christ can. The blood of animals can't. We'll come to begin to look at that from verse 11 to 14 next Sunday morning. So the writer gives to us a description of the tabernacle itself, the two courts, the veils, the furnishings. He gives to us, more importantly, the description of the priestly ministry that went on. And then from verse 8 to 10, he gives us the meaning of it all. What does all this mean? The Holy Ghost is signifying. It's not a matter of what do I think it means. It's a matter, he says, of what does the Holy Ghost say it means. In other words, what is God's interpretation of this? That's what the writer means when he comes to verse 8, 9, and 10. The Holy Spirit signifies this. What does he signify? Well, he signifies this awful truth that you can't have access to God simply by the blood of animals. That the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest. While the first tabernacle was yet standing, because it was only a figure, literally it was only a parable. All of this rich heritage of Israel, it was nothing more than a shadow. It was nothing more than a type. It was nothing more than a parable. It had no meaning in itself. Its meaning was to be found somewhere else, in the same way as the substance of a shadow is found in that which is shadowed. And a type finds its true meaning in the antitype. And a parable, as you know, is bringing things together. When Jesus was preaching his parables and saying the kingdom of heaven is like unto, he is not saying the kingdom of heaven is exactly like unto. He is saying it's like that in a sense. A parable is simply an illustration of something other. And no parable and no illustration indeed is the real thing. The tragedy with Israel was that they thought, they're the children of Moses. We follow Moses. And what Jesus in fact said, if you follow Moses, you're going to end up in death. Because Moses did not invite you to follow him. Moses in fact instructed you to look for the greater one who was to come. To him you must listen. If you were following Moses properly, you would believe in me because Moses was speaking about me. To follow Moses is the way of death. To follow Jesus is the way of life, as Jesus himself puts it. And the tragedy for Israel was that they didn't realize that all of this massive activity around the temple, it had no meaning in and of itself. It was only a shadow of something far greater. And it was destined to pass away, like denominations are, and churches are, and sacraments are. They're all only temporary means to bring us to the truth. The way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest. What did that veil mean? Did it mean that God was saying to the people, come near to me? No, it didn't. It meant that God was saying to the people, stay away from me. Martin Luther, commenting on the reason in Galatians as to why the law was given, he says, the law wasn't given in order to make us good or to make us feel good. He said the law was given to make us feel bad so that we would abandon the law and seek another way, seek God's way of mercy, not by the law but by grace alone. And what the writer is saying, all of this was God was saying to the people, just as he said in the mountain, Mount Sinai, at the time of the giving of the law, he commanded Moses, you remember, don't let these people come near me, lest I break out and destroy them all. So when God was giving this legal structure and offerings of blood upon blood upon blood, only certain representative people, and only once in the whole year, not without blood, God is saying to us, the way to God is not as easy as you think. You can't come to God just any old way, any old how, any old time. There are terms, there are conditions. You must be clean. You must be washed in blood before you can come to God. And yes, there was pardon for the people, but it was ceremonial pardon, not real spiritual pardon at all. The blood of bulls and of goats didn't take away anybody's sin. What did they do then? You say, I've heard Christian preachers say that the blood of bulls and of goats, they could take away sin for those days. No, they could not. The writer to the Hebrews here tells us what the blood of bulls and of goats does. The Holy Ghost signifying that the way into the holiest was not yet manifest. As long as all this structure is in place, God is erecting a barrier between men. He is pointing the way that we can't come in our own righteousness. This was a figure, a parable for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience. We're going to come back to look at conscience when we come to verse 14, the purging of our conscience to serve. You see, as one of the commentators, Donald Guthrie, puts it very well, a conscience that is laden with guilt and with a sense of sin and a sense of its own inadequacy, that conscience can never adequately worship God. Our conscience must be delivered before we can worship and serve the living God, as we're going to see in verse number 14. And it is, we are being reminded here that the blood of animals can never clear the conscience. What can they clean then? They can clean the body, that's all. In verse 10, which stood only in meats and drinks and divers washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them until the time of Reformation. What kind of forgiveness, what kind of cleansing came through the offerings of sacrifices on Israel's altars? It was ceremonial uncleanness that was being dealt with. And we'll see that later on in this very chapter. The blood of bulls and of goats, the ashes of a heifer. If you look at the instances in the Old Testament that the writer is referring to, you will find that it is ceremonial uncleanness. Contact with a dead body, the cleansing of a leper, women in childbirth needed to be purified, so to speak. That's not the forgiveness of sin. That is ceremonial cleanness whereby these people are allowed to come into the community of God's worshippers. And that's all, and that is all that the blood of animals could ever do. It could make you ceremonially acceptable in Israel. criminals, the civil code. Hygienic problems could be covered with offerings. But that's not the forgiveness of sin. The forgiveness of sin has always been by trusting in God's mercy. Even David in Psalm 51, where he speaks, you remember, "Wash me with hyssop and I shall be clean." David is not asking that his sins will be forgiven through the sprinkling of anything by hyssop. The opening verse of Psalm 51 tells us what David was trusting in. "After thy loving kindness, Lord, have mercy upon me." David's mercy was found in God's loving kindness, not in blood or sprinkled by hyssop. But his cleanliness, his social, his ceremonial cleansing, he was an adulterer and a murderer. And he couldn't come into the community of God's people like that. He had to be ceremonially purified. But his sins were forgiven nonetheless. And this is what the writer is saying. And in verse 10, he uses very interesting language, which stood only in meats and drinks and different washings. And these were imposed upon the people of Israel until the time of reformation, until the time of change would come. And when the time of change came, all this was going to be demolished and done away. It had come to its use-by date. And the word here for washings in verse 10 is the word baptisms. And I, for the life of me, fail to see why the translators, and many modern translators too, use this word washings when the word is baptism. The words for baptism usually are translated literally, transliterations, baptisms. But in Mark chapter 7 and here in Hebrews chapter 9, for some strange reason, it's used as washing. Now, of course, baptisms is washing. It's washing. But this would be better translated as baptisms, because what we are being reminded here by the writer to the Hebrews is that the idea of baptisms does not begin in the New Testament. John the Baptist's baptisms are not the beginning of the idea of baptism. John the Baptist was a priest. He was of the tribe of Levi. And when John came baptizing the people, he came sprinkling. Because later on we read of the blood of sprinkling from verse 18 to 23 of this very same chapter. It's the sprinkling of the blood. That's baptisms. And what John was doing with water was what priests had been doing for centuries in Israel. Sprinkling the people to make them ceremonially clean for the coming of the Lord. As we close this morning, we have to be reminded again of what all this is about. There is no earthly administration that can bring us to God. There is no church can do it. There is no sacrament can do it. There is no trusting in a well used and a well-established religious tradition can do it. We sometimes are like the people of Israel. We trust too much in visible structures. And glorious as these structures may be, they are not the real thing. When the New Testament speaks of the church or churches, it doesn't in one instance use that word in reference to any building. Because the church of the New Testament is not a building, it's not a denomination, it is the gathered people of God. God's people are the church. So when we say, "I'm going to the church," we mustn't think, "I'm going to the building known as St. George's in Castlereagh Street." We must say, "I'm going to that place to gather with the saints who gather in that place from time to time." We must have our priorities correct and our vision clear, because I am sure that many, many Christian people to this very day are still confused. If I were to ask you this morning, and on this I'm going to close, if I were to ask you this morning, what is the significance of blood sprinkled, what answer would you give to me? How would you answer that? I'll leave the question with you. because that question is dealt with later on in the chapter. But all of these things are simply until the time of Reformation. And the time of Reformation has now come. But Christ being come, he goes on to say in verse 11, it is Christ and Christ alone, not Christ plus tradition. Christ plus my prayers and my tears and my repentances. It's not Christ plus anything. It's Christ alone, because it is his blood and righteousness. My hope is based on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. And that's what authentic Christianity is all about. And nothing else must be allowed to intrude or take center stage. What is Christianity? Christianity is Christ. And Christ has come. And Christ is our high priest. And if we have Christ, we don't need anything else or any other. I'm sorry that I didn't have more time to say more on that. But this is a rich vein. But it all points to Christ, as we're going to see from verse 11 onwards. May God bless his word to us.